the subject that I am dealing with, you will notice from there, is lessons from mistakes of the past. Lessons from mistakes of the past. First of all, I just want us to be convinced of the importance of going back to the past, going back to the mistakes of the past, and also learning from there. And that's what the introduction is all about. Our students often study history to pass exams. And after that, they throw it away. It's like a can of worms that we use in order to catch fish. And so as soon as we've got fish in the frying pan, why bother with playing with worms anymore? And sometimes they are not the only ones who are guilty of this. We ourselves, as educators, can also have literally the same attitude towards history and end up throwing away that which, in fact, ought to continue being useful to us. So history is not simply something we learn for those primary or immediate results, but history helps us to serve God better in our generation. In fact, it's interesting that our bulletin for the university that's coming out at the end of this month, in fact, I'm seeking to persuade the individuals that read it about the importance of history, that, in fact, we are a better people because we are learning from history. And I want us to see this from a passage that I trust we generally all know, and that is 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 6 down to verse 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 6 to verse 12. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. No grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. And then there is the final plea, and it is this: therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall. Now, I think that's really something that we need to continue applying to us, ourselves, in an ongoing way. It's possible that you may be saying, well, look, that's sacred history. That's something that we can apply to ourselves because it is found in God's word. Now, to some extent, you would be right, but that would be a mistake because all history is God's story. His moral government is in charge of the outworking of history. And that is the reason why we have the plea that we find in verse 12, therefore let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. In other words, the lesson that we are learning from the passages quoted or examples in the Old Testament are to be applied today, that if we make similar mistakes, we will also pay for it dearly. In other words, a generation later, will be able to learn from our mistakes that we did not heed the past and we paid for it, and consequently they not heed our past, they too will pay for it dearly. Or, as we are familiar with the saying, if we do not learn from the mistakes of the past, we are doomed to repeat them. Now that saying, I'm sure you're familiar with it, comes in all kinds of shades and colors, but at the end of the day, it is something to that effect. That if we are not learning from history, that history will repeat itself. Okay, so very quickly then, looking back in history helps us at least in three ways. Number one, what we are primarily concerned today, and that is the history not repeating itself. Okay, not repeating the mistakes of the past. Secondly, it enables us to be challenged to work harder. I am amazed about the fact that when you read, especially biographies, you see just how much one human being was able to do in their lifetime without the internet, without the photocopying facilities that we have, without aeroplanes that enables us to get around within such a short time. It challenges us to say, come on, we can do better. Okay, so that's one of the things that we learn. And then lastly, it is to have a long-term perspective on life. A long-term perspective on life. And what I simply mean by that is the fact that, you know, we are often very impatient. Your college is not growing as fast as the one next door. And you want to start cutting corners because you are anxious. Whereas if you are a reader of church history, or just history in general, you begin to think multi-generational. You think, maybe I'm here for the purpose of laying a solid foundation. Someone else will come and move this to the next phase. History has a tendency to keep us in that kind of perspective and to look forward to fulfilling my role in my generation. Others will come and do the rest. One last point by way of introduction, and it is this, that as I was reading and working through the materials to come and put together in this presentation, I realized that I'm in a sort of multi-denominational context here, and consequently, I will avoid as much as possible referring to actual historical examples so that you don't sit here feeling that I'm after you. All right. There are at least five lessons that I've managed to draw from the various examples, and we'll come and look at them in a moment. But let me at least quote from a paper entitled Lessons from the History of Higher Education. And this was presented in the context of the Church of the Nazarene by Dr. Rodney Reed. And I'll just quote one sentence from there for now. I'll quote him a little later. And it's a statement: we will only find direction for where we are going when we know where we have been. We will only find direction for where we are going when we know where we have been. Another quick matter that I want to have out of the way quickly. And when we are speaking about mistakes, why should we talk about mistakes? Why should there be mistakes? Well, it's primarily because they end up contradicting why we are there. And so I thought very quickly, let's process that. Why have we ended up having Bible colleges? I have just four quick points there. First of all, most Bible colleges began with a felt need, either within a denomination or by a Christian leader. So either it was a denomination together, sitting and talking about some real need that needs to be addressed, and a Bible college is the answer, and I'm using Bible college as the general term for all these education institutions that have to do with teaching teachers of the word. Or it's simply a charismatic leader of a church or denomination, whatever it might be. And by charismatic, I mean it in a general sense, someone who is spirit-empowered and is standing head and shoulders over everyone else and is visionary. He can see where things are going, and consequently, he begins this. And usually, it was a need for more and better equipped preachers and teachers of the Word of God. Referring to the need again, it's often a doctrinal need. A doctrinal need. In other words, the conviction that what we believe is true. And if this belief can only be well known, it will produce the kind of biblical ethics that we ought to be seeing in the church and in the society. The definition of ethics was given a little earlier on. In my mind, I summarize it as attitudes and behavior. And in this case, biblical attitudes and behavior. So let's think quickly. Here we are, we have a denomination. And the denomination is seeing a world that is faltering, going from bad to worse, and realizing that this which we believe in could in fact arrest this decay. Or, we talked about a charismatic leader, he's sitting there and feeling rather hemmed in and realizing that, look, if more people out there believed as I do, there would be a better world out there. And then there is the cry, therefore, that there are too few teachers to teach this. It is usually out of that that you then have colleges starting. And then they start with funding or with support from those who espouse the same passion and doctrine. Generally speaking, if I was to pick a number of your brains here and ask the question, how did your specific colleges begin, I'll most likely find something of this story unveiling itself. So what we're really referring to when we speak in terms of mistakes that have been in the past, we're really talking in terms of what has transpired in colleges between this kind of genesis, this starting, and where those same colleges are now, where they have deviated from these foundational convictions. So we're not necessarily speaking about the fact that the colleges no longer exist. They probably do. We're not even saying that these colleges are fighting for their lives. In other words, they've been reduced to 3 or 5 students. They may have thousands. But what we're referring to is the fact that this doctrinal basis, this conviction that these truths should undergird the lives and ministries of the people that we are training, so that they may consequently have this effect upon society, that cutting edge has been lost. Still there as an institution, but that cutting edge has been lost. Okay, with that rather lengthy introduction, let me quickly go on to the mistakes of the past. And as I've already hinted, there are five of them that are the most important, well, perhaps that have caused this deviation. Let me put it that way. You will always find enough mistakes in the past, but there are at least five that are worth emphasizing at the moment, especially with respect to the failure to, first of all, maintain biblical ethics within the institution, and then also the failure to attain biblical ethics in the world, the society in which the college ought to be sending its products. The very first is the delinking from the life of the local church, and thus colleges becoming more and more academically, I've used the word ethereal there, I couldn't quite find a better term. And earlier when Dr. DeVries was speaking, he used the phrase academia for the sake of academia. I quickly thought, aha, that's what I want. And as I was sitting there, I quickly put it in brackets. And the point, oh, perhaps let me take us back a little bit. A few years ago, I was sitting in a Bible colleges consultation. It drew Bible college principals and perhaps academic deans from Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, and Latin America largely. And the question that they were addressing was, why are our colleges losing that cutting edge that they would have had when they were starting? Why are they losing their impact in the world? And I was thoroughly amazed. At that time, I was not in the actual structures of Bible college training. I'm not even exactly sure why I was invited there. But I was amazed at the very first reason all of them gave, and it is this same one, that we have largely delinked ourselves from the lives of the churches whom we serve. It really, I was thinking they would be fighting against it, but that's something that they brought out. Now, the main reason, obviously, that there is this invariable loss is the fact that the spiritual life of God's people is maintained within the context of local churches. That's where it's maintained. And that's where God's people are constantly expressing the frustrations that they have in living in the real world in which they are. When those who are involved in academia sort of end up flying off that foundation, they end up being involved in, let's use a biblical term, straining gnats while swallowing camels. They end up losing connection with the actual real world in terms of what is happening there. They create a world of their own, which in the process becomes almost irrelevant. Now, I'm speaking a little bit here as a church pastor, and I subscribe to a few journals from Bible colleges. And often when I read them, I keep asking myself, now, what's the relevance of this? I like to believe I'm also an academic. But clearly, you begin to feel like these individuals are not with us on earth. They must be somewhere in another world, and they sort of just visit us from time to time. And often it's this delinking. To the question of how it happens, I will perhaps refer to it, or rather come back to it, when I come to the issue of what we should do. But basically, it's one step at a time. It is the fact that as academicians, especially the management of the academic institution, there is the feeling of wanting to minister further beyond that initial institution that may have been behind the starting of the college. And then as you are bringing in other people that must manage this institution, it is slowly being delinked from the life of the institution itself. But further, it is at the academic level, it is the fact that those who are involved in teaching are no longer in an intimate relationship in the context of the local church. And so invariably, there is the cutting of the mooring and a separation beginning to happen. You see it again and again and again in the various institutions. Perhaps I can hide behind the fact that Dr. DeVries mentioned a few institutions earlier in American history. He mentioned Harvard, Yale, and so on. Again, all you need to do is to go and read that history, and you begin to see how that parting of ways began to happen. Very quickly, the second one. And it is yielding to pressure from society to accept new views and ethics, especially in the area of sex. Now, when I say sex, I don't just mean the act of sex. I'm throwing in gender and everything else, as you'll notice here. But let me quickly open that up just slightly. First of all, society itself tends to go through phases of discoveries, phases of new belief systems, phases of philosophies, new orators, new minds that are invariably causing agitation within society. An obvious example is the one that I've put here, and it goes back ways ago, and that is when the evolutionary theory came into being and began to question creation as it is taught in the scriptures. Again, it became so popular that Bible colleges began to go back to their foundational documents and begin to tailor them to suit the atmosphere of the day. We can go beyond evolution as well to many other repercussions of the scientific discoveries that began to take place, especially in the 19th century. And what you then began to have was a revision of so much. Even, for instance, an obvious example that I can immediately think about is with respect to the days of creation, because of the fact that somehow we need to adopt the millions and millions and millions of years, we then begin to see that between Genesis 1 verse 1 and Genesis 1 verse 2 or 3, we squeeze in millions of years again there, so that somehow we are able to adopt the views that are there in society. More recently is this whole pressure of the roles of the sexes, and more than that now, it's the understanding of marriage and family life, the whole issue of homosexuality, and now they've been thrown in transgenders and everything else. I mean, that's real pressure. Now, it's easier for pastors in the churches to simply continue what they're doing, because all they do is read a Bible verse or two and preach it. But we are at the shop floor of information, and the pressure is felt upon us because we are in the context where we are digging deep. We are challenging thought. We are seeking to develop teachers who will then take this teaching out. Often this pressure has caused faculties in Bible colleges to have head-on collisions between the conservatives and those that are called progressives. And you know, the word progressive seems to be suggesting to you, if you're not following, that you are backward. And nobody wants to be backward. And so invariably, it has caused either a split, or those who are conservative resigning, and in the process, documents being changed and tailor-made in order to suit the atmosphere. And really what happens there is that instead of the colleges as handmaids of the church being salt and light, or to borrow the phrase of being prophetic to the world, it's the world that becomes salt, well, not really salt, light, not really light, to the colleges, and modifying them in the process. Sorry, I think let me just get this out of my pocket. So that's a second one. And let me hurry on to a third. This is supposed to be good news, but as we shall see, it has ended up often being bad news. The tendency for visionaries to grow colleges so fast that they outpace their support base. In other words, within the administration of the college, this whole question of money becomes a menace. Because we are drawing in the numbers, but in drawing in the numbers, we are seeking to give them training at less than the actual market value. In other words, they're not really paying what that training demands. In the process, the tendency has been that to avoid bankruptcy. The colleges begin seeking funding from sources that necessitate a change in their foundational and doctrinal convictions. And there are many colleges that have gone that way. You know that perhaps to get good funding from a particular source, that source has a liberal view of scripture, and they insist it must be so. And hence, because tied up with that support is that demand, you then begin to tailor your doctrinal convictions in order to source that funding. And sometimes it's not so much that you tailor the doctrinal documents, but that it is you bring in lecturers that are paid for from that source. And since that source is not just paying the lecturers, but doing much more to your institution, such as putting up buildings and bringing in all the computers and software that you need, invariably you bring in lecturers that bring in wrong teaching and deviate the college further. The fourth one. Sorry if I'm sounding like a prophet of doom, but that was the topic I was given. Mistakes of the past. Here's the fourth one. It's the opposite of large numbers. In fact, my last two are the opposite of large numbers. Because I'm pretty sure if you are involved in a college, which most of us are, that one of the areas of struggle tends to be maintaining numbers or growing numbers in the institution. The diminishing numbers in enrollment in Bible colleges has often led to unhealthy competition with other colleges instead of a spirit of cooperation. This has resulted in institutional rivalry where only the fittest are able to survive. So it's not so much cooperation, but how much of this pie can I get? How much more? And in getting the how much more, there is obviously a reduction to the others. Now, this is difficult to arrest without us asking ourselves the question, why are we there? Remember where we started from. Why this Bible college? It's difficult to arrest without that. For instance, if you were to say, okay, let's have some form of regulations that will stop this. You cannot tell a Bible college not to get students from a particular territory or denomination simply because other colleges are servicing that area or that denomination. You can't do that. We are in a free world. And consequently, if I attract students from your denomination, despite the fact that you've got your college serving that, tough luck. But also, neither can you tell a college not to seek funding from certain potential funders because other colleges are seeking funding or are already being funded from there. You can't again. So often, you will find colleges that are serving a common area all applying to the same funder. And the funder is sort of sitting there thinking, but what's their problem? Why can't they just work together? But again, you can't stop that. None of you will peep into each other's books to see where you are seeking funding. And then a third one is you also cannot stop them from recruiting lecturers who are already serving in other Bible colleges. Now, to me, this is the worst, where you just find your lecturer has been offered a better package by that college over there. And these are realities. The unhealthy competition. Now remember, the theme for this consultation is ethics. And these are some of the things we need to process. Are we functioning ethically when we are robbing one another in a spirit of competition? Or aren't we now functioning like the world functions? Okay, again, I could give examples after examples, not necessarily that other colleges have closed down, but where all this has been happening, where the one with the money then gets the best lecturers, the ones without the money are then going down and down and down the drain because they just have to face it. They can't afford it. Here is a last lesson, and then we'll go on to talk about some form of solutions. In an effort to grow numbers and thus keep financially afloat, Bible colleges have tended to increase their non-residential or long distance, and I put in brackets, correspondence or online studies, or become general liberal arts colleges. Now, there are times when it's for the right motive. In other words, let's expand our work. But sometimes it is because of finances. Now, let me quickly answer the question, so what's wrong with that? In providing long-distance studies, there's one issue that we often lose, and it is a grip on character formation. That becomes difficult. In fact, sometimes impossible. The advantage with a residential situation is that you are dealing with the individuals face to face. Back home at our church, we run an internship program, and we tend to have interns from all over Africa coming in. In fact, once or twice we've had them coming in from Europe and Canada. But the thing is that almost all of these would be graduates of Bible colleges. They've already got their papers. And usually by this time, it runs from January to December, usually by June, we are able to say these guys cannot make pastors. Forget it. But these, there's hope. Usually by June. And often it happens in their, we've got two houses where they live. Often it happens there. You are being called in again and again to put out fires. Fights between them. And soon you begin to see which characters are constantly causing the fights. Now, the point is, it's because we are with them.
and we are dealing with these issues. At a distance, we give them reading and writing assignments, by the way. So when they are bringing these in, you can give them very high scores on paper. But in life, you would not dare give them even a small congregation. So we tend to lose out on that. And again, remember, we are concerned about ethics. In other words, not just the doctrinal regurgitation, but the changing of attitudes and behavior that we ought to be seeing within the context of the institution itself. The expansion in terms of now becoming full-fledged colleges that are teaching anything and everything in order to develop society, again, there's something honorable about that. But again, it's the fact of losing the initial focus. That's why I began with, why Bible colleges? Why? What was the foundation? And you noted that we saw that it was on training preachers and teachers of the word. Well, I warned you, by the gift of making long stories longer, what should we do? The first is that of remaining linked to church. Well, first of all, it's churches, but I knew the answer would be we are. Because what we mean is that in our constitution, we belong to churches. So at least we are serving churches. So I'm thinking here in terms of actual serving pastors. Those who are dealing with the day-to-day problems of ordinary Christians in the congregation. Having a vital connection with them. Now, one way would be to try and insist that our own lecturers should be serving pastors, but as you realize, that's not always realistic. Another way is to say that serving pastors should at least come in and take some courses so that we are intermingling with them. Another way would be to say that serving pastors should be in the board of trustees or should be in the advisory board or whatever you might call it. But certainly a vital link so that the college doesn't fly off the foundation, so to speak. And then quickly, secondly, and this ties in with what we are doing here. It is to maintain healthy consultation and cooperation rather than unhealthy competition among Bible colleges. Let me quote Dr. Reed, whom I quoted earlier on. He says, perhaps a certain amount of fair competition could be good even for educational providers. But we must always keep in mind that we are all on the same team, working together for a common goal, the fulfillment of the Great Commission mandate. I love what he says here. Our real competitor is the enemy of our souls. If we compete with one another, rather than cooperate with each other, we play into his hands. And I thought, wow, that was a wise statement made there. Three statements about consultation and cooperation. And then I'll close with a reflection. Consultation and cooperation indirectly reminds us of our reason for existence. Those two. When in your own management, you are feeling the pressure
and your mind is beginning to wander the wrong way, it is when you meet with others that you begin to realize, hey, what was I thinking of? What a fool I've been. You are brought back to your senses, so to speak. And also consultation helps us to learn best practices from one another. There will be quite a few workshops that we'll be going through, and we'll be speaking in small groups and so forth. And during those times, you actually learn a lot that enables you to see that that mountain is actually an anthill. Others have been there and they've overcome. And lastly, cooperation enables us to share resources, especially human resources. So instead of me offering your lecturer better pay and consequently stealing him, because we are relating, we are cooperating, I could actually ask that a number of hours by your lecturer can be offloaded here to the benefit of our own students, etc., etc. So these are just a few thoughts that I went through in terms of us answering the question, okay, there's been mistakes made in the past. And of those five that I put together, the thought was, fine, what can we do not to go the same way? And you will notice that the answer has not been sort of for each one of them, but I've tried to give a holistic kind of answer that this might help. Finally, for personal reflection, and I'm hoping that you will deliberately do that. What kind of pressures are you experiencing today? And what compromises in ethics, that is, in terms of attitudes or behavior, are beginning to happen in you and in your institution? Because you all, or shall I say, we all are experiencing pressure. Because we are in a real world. And what we saw from 1 Corinthians 10 was that we shouldn't just take it for granted that we are standing. Let's take heed lest we fall. So some honest introspection could be of great help.